This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering Gardner and the towns of Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Petersham, Templeton, Westminster, and Winchendon. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashburnham, Petersham, and Winchendon, and thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. It's Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, and in the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Gardner News. This is Dave Russell reading with Risa Sachs. Our first story from Gardner, Mackey Building Centers to open rental center at Gardner location. When it opens. Greater Gardner do-it-yourselfers looking to tackle some outdoor spring cleaning and landscaping will not have to travel very far to rent the necessary equipment. Officials at Mackey Building Centers have announced they will open a rental station at their Gardner location at 513 Betty Spring Road. The center, which will officially open on May 1st, will offer mini excavators and lawn care equipment, chippers, skid steer attachments, lifts, and more. Jeff Cassette, manager of Mackey's rental centers in Gardner and Lunenburg, said the company had been looking to expand its rental services into the area for several years. Then came the news late last year that the owners of Taylor Rental, Pete and Madeline Gamache, would be retiring and closing their Gardner store after nearly 50 years. We reached out to them, and Greg Tardiff, the manager over there, decided he wanted to come on board with us, Cassette said. So we figured we'd take that opportunity to extend out to Gardner so that the people in that area could continue to rent locally. The Gamaches are in the process of selling off their inventory and plan to permanently close their store by the end of April. Tardiff, who worked at Taylor Rental for 37 years, said he was grateful for the opportunity to utilize his experience in the rental business for Mackey. I wasn't quite ready to retire, and when the guys from Mackey were in our store a few months ago talking about expanding rentals into Gardner, they offered me the job, and I took it, he said. When they first brought up the idea, I was kind of excited because, to be quite frank, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do after so many years in the same business. Cassette said there was a clear need for rental services in the greater Gardner area. We've been seeing a void between here and, say, Athol for the past several years, he said. I do a lot of traveling from Lunenburg out to Ashburnham, Gardner, Orange, and Princeton. We definitely see a void in that whole area for rental. Tardiff said he was happy that his longtime customers would still be able to rent locally. So many customers at Taylor Rental were wondering where they'd have to go, thinking they would have to go to Lemonster or Athol. So everybody was excited to hear that Mackey would be opening a rental center in Gardner, he said. I have a feeling I'm going to see a lot of familiar faces. Cassette, who lives in Gardner, described the confluence of events, the Gamaches retiring, Tardiff continuing in the rental business, and customers still having a local rental center as a win-win for everyone involved. Tardiff will not be the only former Taylor Rental employee keeping busy after the store's closure. Mike Griska and Matt Francis purchased the center's party inventory and delivery truck and will continue to rent it out under their new online banner, Party Tents and Events. Cassette said Mackey and Party Tents and Events would not operate in direct competition, however. We're going to do a little bit of a referral program, he said. If they have people call them interested in renting equipment, they'll send them to us, and vice versa. If someone needs a tent or party rentals, we're going to send it over to them. Our next story, Winchendon receives $9.5 million grant to replace failing water main. When construction starts. This is written by Amelia Cardona. After over a year of waiting, Winchendon officials have received a $9.5 million grant from the Massachusetts Clean Water Trust to replace the town's main pipe that brings water to 2,100 homes and businesses. The 74-year-old water main has exceeded its official lifespan. The town's water infrastructure system could fail at any time, and hundreds of residents will lose access to clean water. Brian Croto, director of the Winchendon Public Works Department, said when they hire a contractor, they will have to send the monthly expense bill to the state so the town can be reimbursed. He said the state reimbursable grant would pay for the project, and the engineers at Tye and Bond, the engineering and design firm hired by the town, estimated it to cost about $9.5 million. Croto said the town had spent $199,000 so far on maps and design of the project to create a package to submit for state grants and the search for a contractor. He said the money was from the American Rescue Plan Act, awarded to the town during the COVID-19 pandemic. PWD officials expect to break ground between late July and early August. The replacement project will take a year to complete, and PWD officials said the timetable would depend on what the weather was during the winter. Construction, which is expected to continue during the winter, will have to stop if snow and extreme weather are forecast. The construction will run for 5 miles from the Ashburnham-Winchendon Water Filtration Plant on Lake Road in Ashburnham to Sherbert Road and ending at North Ashburnham Road. Public Works officials are searching for a contractor with the proper labor and machinery capacity to take on an infrastructure project of this large size. The PWD officials' deadline to pick a contractor is early next month. The issue is not getting worse, but it's not getting younger, and this is extremely essential for residents on Winchendon Municipal Water, he said. This is their main and only source of water. Croto said this year they have not experienced any catastrophic breaks on the main water pipe, but they have experienced about 10 to 15 water breaks on smaller pipes that they were able to fix. He said the department always has between $250,000 and $300,000 worth of parts in order to be ready to respond to any leak or break on any given day. Now we turn to Ashburnham, seeking a $1.2 million grant to remove the Whitney Pond Dam, where the project stands. This is written by Amelia Cardona. 6 years after Ashburnham residents voted to remove the Whitney Pond Dam, construction is projected to start in the summer of 2025. Preparations for the removal are planned to start next spring and finish in late summer 2025. The timeline is based on whether Ashburnham officials are awarded the $1.2 million to fund the project. Dr. Jessica V.C. Powell, a Nashua Watershed Association scientist and coordination project manager for the Whitney Pond Dam project, said the design phase and gathering all the proper permits are 80% complete. The town received $140,000 from the dam and seawall repair or removal grant to begin the removal project in 2019. Susie Bresney, a Mass Division of Ecological Restoration specialist, said the grant pays for the design and permitting work for the past 5 years. So far, the town has received $45,000 from the Department of Ecological Restoration to pay for community outreach efforts and continue monitoring the dam's water quality in the 2024 fiscal year. V.C. Powell said they have submitted 4 grant applications and will be notified in late July if the town has been awarded the money. The biggest grant is the Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Grant Program, which would cover most of the project's costs. I can't predict, but there's a lot of grant money coming into dam removal projects in the state, she said. The project itself is a good project. In 2017, during a routine inspection, the Massachusetts Dam Office categorized the Whitney Pond Dam as a significant safety hazard. There's no particular use for the dam any longer. The dam has not been used for hydropower since 1975. The Whitney Pond Dam is located on the Whitman River across Center Street in Ashburnham. According to the Mass Dam Office inspection done in 2017, if the town does not remove or repair the dam, which is in extremely poor condition according to the routine inspection, it has a high chance of failure, which can cause significant flooding and major damage to homes downstream. Over a year ago, the Nashua River Watershed Association and the Massachusetts Division of Ecological Restoration got involved with the dam removal project, and staff have helped officials with grant applications, community outreach, and project planning. In 2018, the decision was made after town officials and residents reviewed a financial analysis that estimated the dam's repairs to cost between $611,000 and $994,000. And the annual maintenance would cost between $8,000 and $15,000. Also in 2018, the estimate for removal cost was between $880,000 and $990,000. According to V.C. Powell, the updated dam removal cost is $1.2 million. V.C. Powell said the removal cost is higher than estimated in 2018 because of inflation. She said the annual maintenance cost would also be higher if they updated the estimate. However, she said, the town decided it was the most cost-effective decision because it would remove any financial burden from the Ashburnham taxpayers. Even after the dam is removed, the project is not complete. Wetland restoration is the next phase for the Ashburnham wetlands, which will ensure a healthy environment and prevent future flooding. V.C. Powell said the dam removal benefits not only the safety of town residents, but also improves water quality and the overall habitat of many native cold water river fish. Wetland restoration involves the removal of contaminated soil in the dam impoundment, monitoring fish populations, regrowth of native vegetation, and water quality. Our next story, calling all educators. Oakmont is hosting a job fair with more than a dozen districts. This is written by Stephen Landry. Officials from several local school districts will gather next month to connect, network, and showcase the career opportunities available locally in the educational field. The second annual Educator Job Fair will take place at the Oakmont Regional High School in Ashburnham on Thursday, May 2nd from 4 to 7 p.m. Organizers said the goal of the event is to give educators in grades pre-K to 12 and support staff an opportunity to meet with representatives from several school districts across the state. The initial idea to invite multiple school districts to gather in one location came about after organizers noticed a number of employees not returning to the educational field in the post-COVID years. That, according to Stacy Cristiano, Director of Human Resources in the Ashburnham-Westminster Regional School District, we figured we could have a job fair, get all of the districts together to double our traffic, and work collaboratively to really see if we could get some quality people to fill these positions, Cristiano said. The positive response to last year's fair was overwhelming, according to organizers. Everybody was excited to be part of this great networking opportunity, and we were able to match people with certain skill sets with other districts based on need, she said. We were thrilled with the turnout we had. Districts and schools scheduled to participate in this year's job fair include Narragansett Regional School District, Fitchburg Public Schools, Quabbin Regional School District, Wachusett Regional School District, Worcester Public Schools, Mahar Regional School, Neshoba Regional School District, Keystone Educational Collaborative, Winchendon Public Schools, Southbridge Public Schools, Athol-Royalston Regional School District, CAPS Collaborative, and Nantucket public schools. In addition to educators looking to enter the field or advance their careers, the job fair is aimed at those seeking possible employment in other fields. Most districts currently have several job openings listed on their websites, including teachers, paraeducators, nurses, counselors, school psychologists, grant developers, electricians, drivers, summer staff, and custodians. The fair last year stood out as the most welcoming and well-organized job fair of the many we attended, said Anne-Marie Stoika, Director of Human Resources in the Neshoba Regional School District. We are delighted to be invited again. We kind of look at it as a one-stop shop for somebody seeking employment, said Justine Muir, director of AWSRD Pupil Services. It happened quite a bit last year that someone would come up to our table looking for a certain position that we didn't have open at the time. But if we knew that, say, Neshoba across the gym did have an opening, we would walk that person right over to their table. A representative from the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education Licensure Office will again be attending this year's job fair, according to Cristiano. This presents an excellent opportunity for those seeking guidance or assistance with their educator licenses to receive immediate support and advice, she said. We have some staff last year who got some guidance on how to become fully licensed in their field. Organizers were planning on making the job fair an annual regional event, according to Muir. We definitely hope to continue this every year for a long time, she said. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Right now, Risa Sachs joins us, and she has more Gardner news for you. Risa?
Thank you, Dave. And we'll begin this segment of this evening's program with a story about pets. It's by Stephen Landry of the Gardner News. Purple Paws Walk shines an important light on domestic violence in Gardner. Household pets often the, quote, forgotten victims, quote, of domestic violence. Don't forget the pet. That's the message as the Paws for a Good Cause return for another walk in the park in Gardner. The second annual Purple Paws Walk, which is aimed at raising awareness about keeping household pets safe from domestic abuse situations, will take place at Pulaski Dog Park on Saturday, April 27th, from 9:30 a.m. to noon. Residents are urged to attend the free event with their canine companions. The Purple Paws Pet Program, a collaboration between the Gardner Domestic Violence Task Force, Voices of Truth, and animal shelters across Greater Gardner, is aimed at finding temporary foster shelters for domestic pets that are left behind when their owners are forced to leave home to escape a toxic relationship. Bernice Richard, president of the Voices of Truth and coordinator of the Greater Gardner Domestic Violence Task Force, said last year's event, which was organized partly to raise money for the fosters who temporarily take in the pets and keep them while they wait to be reunited with their owners, raised about $4,000. The support is absolutely amazing, Richard said. One of the things we've been hearing as we've gone around getting vendors and sponsors for the walk is that many people never even considered what happened to the pets in these situations. It's such an emotional eye-opener, especially if you're a pet owner yourself. April is Pet Abuse Awareness Month. The event will begin with Mayor Michael Nicholson reading a proclamation stating that April will officially be known as Pet Awareness Month in Gardner, according to Richard. The event is not just about raising money, it's also about raising awareness, Richard said. The success of last year's walk was evident by the increased donations from returning sponsors and the number of new businesses that signed up to take part in this year's event, Richard said. Sponsors for this year's walk, which will include raffle prizes from local businesses, include GFA, Gardner Auto Mart, Empire Management, Parker House of Pizza, Four Seasons Chinese Cuisine, and Anne's Bridal and Tux. We've got gift cards galore, Richard said. It's mind-blowing how the sponsors are coming on board. The message is really getting out. Pets, the, quote, forgotten victims, quote, of domestic violence. It's a sad fact that pets are often the target of abuse during domestic violence situations, according to Richard. The Purple Paws Pet Program, which was established 2 years ago, is dedicated to persuading victims of toxic relationships who are often hesitant to leave their dog or cat behind that their pets will be kept safe in an undisclosed location until the animals are reunited with their owners. The stories we've been hearing are horrific. The victims have some very sad stories, but we're not forgetting these pets, Richard said. About 71% of domestic violence victims reported that their abusers also targeted their pets. The program recently began collaborating with Betsy BNB, that's a link to a website, a national organization dedicated to securing safe, temporary homes for pets during their owners' times of crises, Richard said. They do all the work. They do all the paperwork. They do all the monitoring. And all we need to do is find people willing to be fosters, Richard said. The Rain or Shine event at 2 Charbonneau Street will feature live music, pet-related vendors, resource tables, a police canine and bloodhound demonstration, and a pet costume parade. Our next story deals with the old Bank of America building. It's also by Stephen Landry of the Gardner News. Vacant for 5 years, Gardner's old Bank of America building has been sold. Property has been vacant for 5 years. The new owners of the former Bank of America building in downtown Gardner have big plans for the property, which has been vacant for nearly 5 years. Gardner-based Empire Management announced on April 9th that it purchased the building at 29 Parker Street for $825,000 from developer Tony Molina, who bought the property 2 years ago. The former bank is directly across the street from Empire Management Office, which opened in 1994. We look at that building every single day, and since we are committed to the revitalization of downtown Gardner, we're really excited to have the opportunity to purchase it, said Gabriel Surrette, the Empire Management Office Manager. Plans for the property include utilizing the first floor for a higher-end family restaurant, according to Empire Management President Jenna Hartman. When we first started the conversation, we would have had the restaurant ideally by the end of this year. But with contractors and everything like that, it's kind of hard to say exactly. But we would love for it to open by the end of this year, Hartman said. Discussions are continuing with a potential tenant interested in opening the restaurant, she said. One of the property's most attractive features for tenants will be the parking, Surrette said. Not only is the building beautiful, but it has 2 parking lots, which is awesome, she said. Both floors are pretty accessible as well. What about the bank vault and the second floor? Another unique feature is the former bank's large vault on the first floor. The vault is going to be a big focal point for the restaurant. They're really excited about having that, and they definitely have some ideas for it. That vault is not going anywhere, Hartman said. The second floor will likely be the new location for a medical arts center, according to Surrette. At the moment, we are in negotiations with a pediatrics firm out of Texas, which has expanded to other areas of Massachusetts and are looking to open an office in Gardner, she said. We have also had a mental health office that is looking to relocate and expand their practice to Gardner. The new second floor tenant could be fully moved in by late fall, Surrette added. Downtown Renaissance in full swing. The move to revitalize the downtown area is in full swing, according to Surratt. We are not only happy to be part of it, we've been in Gardner and in business for 30 years, so we've been here for a long time, and we're going to stay here for a long time. And it seems like things are going nowhere but up, she said. We're thrilled to be part of it and to be contributing to it. The public response to Empire Management's purchase of the building had been overwhelmingly positive, according to Surratt. I think the most heartwarming messages we've received are from people who are excited and happy that the new owners are people who have lived here for so long, she said. The outside investors are great. There's no downside to that. But people are glad it's a local business revitalizing buildings that have stood there for years and bringing them back to life. Amber Labonte, the city's economic development coordinator, welcomed the opportunity for a new restaurant and medical center in downtown Gardner. Local businesses often want to be part of a community they serve, too, so I think we're likely to see events that will directly benefit Gardner's local population, she said. Our next story continues the renovation theme and looks at the Fitchburg Library. Delayed Fitchburg Library renovations set to begin this year, city says. It's by Tatum Getting of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. Fitchburg. The city expects to begin renovations on the public library later this year, with completion of the project expected in 2026, about a year later than originally scheduled. The library on Main Street has been closed since fall 2023, but has offered programs and services at a temporary location at 166 Boulder Drive, where it will continue to operate until the renovations at 610 Main Street are complete. The project, expected to cost $40 million, involves two major changes for the library. Renovation of the Wallace Library to include more community spaces, and the addition of a children's library and learning center that will replace the existing youth library. Fitchburg Library Director Deb Hinkle said the goal of the project is to provide materials and experiences Fitchburg residents might not otherwise be able to afford. The community room is going to be a really flexible space that can be sectioned off into two spaces instead of just one, Hinkle said. We're incorporating several smaller meeting rooms, a computer lab, and a maker space. We're going to have an increase in seating areas where people can study and engage with each other. The project means more gathering spaces, including a lounge area and more conference rooms. Our mission is to provide access to information and education opportunities without a direct cost to the patron, Hinkle said. There are few places left in the world where you can go without being forced to make a financial transaction. This is one of those places, so this is one of the most important community hubs. It's about accessibility. The existing 29,700 square foot Wallace Library, named for the Wallace family who owned Fitchburg Paper and funded the library's construction in the 1960s, is over 50 years old. The new youth library wing adds 25,730 square feet, bringing the new facility to 55,430 square feet. Funding for the project comes from numerous sources. $12.4 million from a grant from the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners Library Construction Program grant. $12 million from the City of Fitchburg's American Rescue Plan Act funding. $3.5 million from the OWL, or Offering a World of Learning, capital campaign, and the remaining $12 million from the City of Fitchburg. The start of construction was delayed due to changes in the federal flood maps, which resulted in new design criteria. The plan is now to break ground later this year. We identified a path forward, and the project is still within the allocated budget, Engel said. The public library is the true building for the people, and the city is committed to ensuring the central piece of community social infrastructure moves forward with a state-of-the-art library that benefits all people, Mayor Samantha Sequila said in a statement. We have worked through the design challenges on this major capital project with our design team, project managers, and city officials, and will continue to work in close collaboration to oversee the project and ensure we remain within budget. As a gateway city, it's imperative to highlight how having a modern library will better the economy for local businesses, create more inviting places, and provide that access to information and educational opportunities for people who need them, Engel said. We also want to utilize this new space and reimagine and expand our programming. This is an opportunity for the library to provide services for people who would not be able to otherwise afford them. That completes this segment of this evening's program, so we'll hand it back to Dave, and I will be back later in the program for the final segment tonight. So, over to you, Dave.
Thank you, Risa. Our next story, annual town meeting season is approaching. Here's what you need to know. This is written by Amelia Cardona. Before the summer season approaches, the six towns in the greater Gardner area prepare for the purest practice of democracy, the annual town meeting. The city of Gardner does not have a town meeting form of government. Instead, it operates with a mayor and city council. Between May and early June, residents and town officials of Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Phillipston, Templeton, Westminster, and Winchendon gather to vote on the submitted fiscal year 2025 budget and any supplemental funding needed for local government and school operations. Residents must register to vote at least 10 days in advance for their community's annual town meeting. Here is what you need to know about your town's annual meeting. Westminster and Ashburnham are first. The annual town meeting for Westminster voters is on Saturday, May 4th at 10 a.m. in the Westminster Elementary School. You can get a town meeting warrant booklet by calling 978-874-7408. Westminster residents had until today, Wednesday, April 24th, to register to vote. Ashburnham town officials plan to hold the annual town meeting on Tuesday, May 7th at 7 p.m. in the Oakmont High School auditorium. No warrant has been posted yet on the town's website. The registration deadline to vote in Ashburnham is Saturday, April 27th, this Saturday. Looking at Phillipston and Templeton, Phillipston officials plan to hold their annual meeting on Wednesday, May 8th at 7 p.m. in the Phillipston Memorial Building Gymnasium. Officials have stated on the town's website that voters will decide whether to approve an override that will allocate $175,000 to the fiscal year 2025 budget to cover all costs of the town and school operation budget. The warrant for the annual town meeting was released on the website as of last Monday. The deadline to register to vote in Phillipston is next Monday, April 29th. The annual town meeting in Templeton is on Wednesday, May 15th at 6 p.m. in the Narragansett Regional Auditorium. The voter registration deadline for Templeton residents is on Monday, May 6th. For Winchendon, officials plan to hold the annual town meeting on Monday, May 20th at 7 p.m. in the Murdoch Middle School. The voter registration deadline is Friday, May 10th. The Board of Selectmen voted to finalize the warrant this past Monday, April 22nd. The Finance Committee hosted a public hearing last night, Tuesday, April 23rd, to inform voters on what's in the warrant before the annual town meeting. Looking at Hubbardston, officials hosted a hybrid annual town meeting review and public hearing on Tuesday, April 16th in the Slade Building. If you couldn't attend, the meeting was recorded and posted on Town's Public Access TV YouTube account. The voter registration deadline for Hubbardston residents is on Saturday, May 25th. On Tuesday, June 4th, voters will approve the warrant reviewed during the hearing at the annual town meeting in the Hubbardston Center School starting at 7 p.m. Again, that's Tuesday, June 4th. Next, we turn our attention to Winchendon. El Toro Restaurant coming to Winchendon. Why is it leaving Fitchburg? The Bull is coming to Toy Town. The owners of El Toro, the popular upside Fitchburg Steakhouse, said they would soon be moving their restaurant, complete with a revamped family-friendly menu, to the former Carriage House restaurant at 660 Spring Street in Winchendon. Leslie and Roberto Cologne, who opened El Toro 2 years ago, said their restaurant on River Street was an immediate success. The idea behind opening El Toro was to have something locally, so we didn't have to travel to Worcester or Boston or any other big city to be able to get a nice steak. Especially with our jobs, we didn't have the capability of driving an hour to Boston, then taking an hour to come home. We wanted a neighborhood family restaurant that was a little upscale, Leslie said. The Colognes, who cut their eatery teeth as partial owners of the Game On restaurant bar and grill in Fitchburg, said the popularity of El Toro demonstrated that there was a desire for an upscale restaurant in the area. Realistically, we were testing the area to see if a restaurant of this caliber would draw people into Fitchburg, and it did. And not just Fitchburg, but the surrounding community, said Roberto. We carved our own niche because there weren't any high-end steak restaurants nearby. Within a 20-mile radius, there was nothing. Satisfied that the public would support their establishment, the couple decided they had outgrown their original location and began searching for a new site for the restaurant. When they learned that the former Carriage House was available, they immediately made an offer to purchase the site. We were really fortunate that this location came up and was available because it's a high-traffic area and we'll have cars going into Ringe and Jaffrey and other populated areas, and I think that it will attract people traveling to Worcester or Leominster. They can stop here and get some quality food, Roberto said. The new location's large kitchen and 140 seating capacity will allow El Toro to expand its menu to include Italian and French cuisine and more family-friendly items, in addition to steak dishes. The owners are dropping Steakhouse from the new restaurant's name. We'd love to turn around and have a pasta dinner for six that's affordable so families can come in and enjoy an evening out without breaking the bank, Roberto said. Because we have a bigger space, we can now turn around and have chicken dinners and fish dinners and spaghetti dinners and hamburgers. The menu is not going to be exclusively steak, Leslie said. We're expanding to comfort food, and we'll have rotating specials to try to fit everybody's comfort zone. Motorists will begin to see the new El Toro sign go up within a week or so. The restaurant is scheduled to open in June. It all depends on the liquor license, but if the liquor license comes back in the middle of May, we'll open in the middle of May, according to Roberto. Town manager Bill McKinney said the town was excited to welcome El Toro to the community. They have developed a great reputation at their previous location, and they'll have a great location on one of the main roads in town, he said. This is another great dining option for the residents, as well as for those who visit Winchendon to take advantage of our recreational opportunities and events at the amphitheater. Roberto said he was grateful to be welcomed to the community, calling Winchendon a business-friendly town. El Toro's entire 15-person Fitchburg staff will be employed at the new location, according to Roberto. He said the restaurant will be open 6 days a week to start, the goal of being open for lunch and dinner all week. He said he was interested in possibly adding an outdoor seating area in the future. Now a local sports story. Ready to party? What you need to know about Greater Gardner's four golf courses. This is written by Jay Guerin. The 2024 golf season is up and running, with players teeing up and enjoying the fairways and greens and the pleasant April weather. So dust off your golf clubs, get ready to hit the links. Here's a handy guide to help you prepare and know more about the golf courses in the Greater Gardner area. Of course, there's Gardner Municipal Golf Course at 152 Eaton Street in Gardner. It was established in 1936 and is a par 71 course. This article covers daily rates and memberships, but will give you the opportunity to contact a course of your choosing in order to find out some of this detailed information. Jay Guerin does write about tournament time. It all began back in 1948 when Leo Menny won the first DeLay Memorial Golf Tournament at GMGC. The tradition continues in late May over the Memorial Day weekend when the 77th annual DeLay Championship will be held. Bill Wilson, a six-time DeLay champion who won by 10 shots last year with rounds of 75, 70, and 74, will defend his title. At Templewood Golf Course, 160 Brooks Road in Templeton, established in 1999, and a par 70 course, Jay Guerin notes the longest holes. Number one, a 545-yard par 5 downhill, and hole number 18, a monster 583-yard uphill par 5. Looking at Westminster Country Club, 51 Ellis Road in Westminster, a par 71 course, he writes, Mass Golf recently selected WCC's 250-yard 12th hole among the longest of par 3 holes in the state. Prepare for a thrilling challenge, states the description on the Mass Golf website. Then another course, the Woods of Westminster, 90 Bean Porridge Hill Road in Westminster, established in 1998, a par 72 course. New for 2024 at the Woods, tee areas have been expanded on many holes, drop-in leagues are now an option, and 20 refurbished motorized carts have been added to the fleet. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Right now, we have the final segment of the Gardner News for this evening, and joining us once again is Risa Sachs. Risa?
Thank you again, Dave. And we'll begin this final segment of this evening's program with a story based in Winchendon, looking at Lake Menominac. It's by Amelia Cardona of the Gardner News. 200 acres of forest land by Lake Menominac in Winchendon bought by trusts. What's next? After a year of partnership, North Country Land Trust and Mount Grace Land Conservation Trust, that would be MGLCT, and the North Country Land Trust is NCLT, those initials will come up later, finally bought 249 acres of forest land in Winchendon around Lake Menominac. The two regional land conservation organizations raised $675,000 to buy the land, as well as cover the cost of community outreach, surveying, and future improvements to recreational trails. Lake Menominac, is a man-made lake that stretches into Ringe, New Hampshire. The long, skinny lake branches out to the Millers River watershed in Winchendon. We feel like we're in a big race to protect our forests and farmlands, so it's great to have such a good partner in North County to work with together to meet this need, Emma Ellsworth, Mount Grace Land Conservation Executive Director, said. This is critical for climate mitigations to keep our water pure and drinkable for our wildlife and biodiversity. Ellsworth said threats to open space across the state have increased rapidly as more land is used for new and solar development. She said organizations like hers have experienced a lot more pressure to move faster to protect more land in North Central Massachusetts region as more developers are looking out west. More than a year ago, the two land conservation organizations estimated they would need over $700,000, but were able to purchase it for less money. How will the land be protected from development? The land conservation trusts are establishing a land conservation restriction, a permanent deed restriction completed through the Registry of Deeds. The restriction is a strategy nonprofits use to protect conservation areas from developers. A land conservation restriction identifies the significant ecological features of the land and how it benefits the public from preserving the land's natural state. Anna Wilkins, NCLT executive director, said that they decided that the MGLCT would be the organization that would hold the deed. Land Warriors Capital Company bought and then sold the land. This land conservation project was not Mount Grace Land Conservation's first attempt to buy the hundreds of forested acres around Lake Monominac. Wilkins said that about 10 years ago, the MGLCT was outbid by the previous owner of the Land Warriors Capital Company. She said at that time, the business was known as the Automobile Credit Rehabilitation Company, and the 350 acres of forest land were valued at $1.3 million. In 2023, Land Warriors Capital Company put the land up for sale for $885,000. In February, NCLT purchased 71 acres from the Land Warriors Capital Company for $260,000, and a Lake Monominac resident purchased the remaining 280 acres for $625,000. The two conservation land organizations negotiated with the resident that he would hold onto the 178 acres of the land and sell it to the organizations at a bargain price of $267,000. In January 2024, NCLT became owners of 249 acres and sold 65 acres to the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife for $84,000. The remaining 184 acres of forest land will be used as a conservation area with a small four-spot gravel parking lot, marked trails with trailheads, an information kiosk, and benches. Ellsworth said the Mass Division of Fisheries and Wildlife plans to build a boat launch deck on the acreage they bought, extending the Winchendon Springs Wildlife Management Area. How did they raise the money? What's really unique about this project is that it was almost entirely funded by private money, she said. We worked with private foundations and the community around the lake to fund the project. Seven private charitable foundations awarded grants to the two land conservation organizations, which they put toward the fundraiser goal. Wilkins said the Winchendon Spring Lake Association and the Monominac Lake Property Owners Association also contributed significantly to the project efforts. It was a real community project because a lot of Winchendon people cared about this area, and they recognized how special it was, not only for wildlife, but for the community, she said. The town of Winchendon was not eligible for state grants because it had no up-to-date recreation and open space plan. When can people start hiking around Lake Monominac? Lake Monominac is open for recreational purposes. Ellsworth said locals have established unofficial trails in the area and have used them for many years, but NCLT plans to clean up the trails and improve the recreational experience. Wilkins said they plan to complete a small gravel parking lot and a marked main trail by June. She also said trails need a lot of clearing to make them accessible to hikers, so volunteers are crucial. The next volunteer work days to clean up the trails at Monominac Hill are Saturday, May 18th at 9:30 a.m. and Tuesday, June 11th at 4:30 p.m. Again, that's Saturday, May 18th at 9:30 a.m. and Tuesday, June 11th at 4:30 p.m. Snacks, water refills, and tools are provided. Wilkins said they encourage people to bring tools if they have any. To volunteer, please register through the organization's website. The NCLT plans to host a ribbon-cutting ceremony in August to officially mark the grand opening of the Monadnock Hill Conservation Area. Our next stories all deal with flora and fauna around the area. When is the average last frost in Massachusetts? What to know to plant your garden? It's by Seth Jacobson of the USA Today Network. The weather can be funny in New England. The weather has been warming up lately, but you know what they say about New England weather. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes and it will change. The question for gardeners is, will it continue to warm up, making it time to plant our tender annuals that would die in a frost, or is there another frost likely in the future? For that, gardeners turn both to forecasts and to the average last frost date to help them get the timing right for planting out in the dirt. What is the average last frost date? The last frost dates are estimated based on historical data of when the last freeze, when temperatures drop between 29 degrees and 32 degrees Fahrenheit, cool enough to kill tender plants, is likely to occur according to the Old Farmer's Almanac. This information is calculated down to zip code to help gardeners plan their crops. In Massachusetts, the average last frost date varies depending on where you live. For example, on Cape Cod, the average last frost date in Chatham is April 13th, while in Worcester, the average last frost date is April 23rd, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration data. In Western Mass, the average date often falls in May. You can look up your local last frost date on an interactive NOAA map. That's the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration map. But even when you know your average last frost date, there is a catch. The probability of a frost occurring after the spring frost date or before the last fall frost date is 30%, which means there's still a chance of frost occurring before or after the given date, the Old Farmer's Almanac says, which is why gardeners also need to check the forecast. Does the National Weather Service think a spring frost could happen? Chances are low, but a meteorologist from the National Weather Service says nothing is out of the question. Bruce Williams, a meteorologist from the National Weather Service in Norton, said while it's not out of the question for Massachusetts, having a frost this late in April would be rare. At this point, the odds of getting a frost would be extremely low, Williams told Wicked Local on Tuesday morning. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but it would be a surprise. Is there a history of spring frosts in Massachusetts? You bet. Meteorologist Bruce Williams said there are points in history when frosts have arrived late in the spring. He said some of those include Boston, May 3rd, 1882, was freezing or below freezing. Boston, May 3rd, 1874, was freezing or below freezing. Worcester, May 19th, 1944, was freezing or below freezing. Worcester, May 19th, 1976, was freezing or below freezing. Williams said the most recent one in Worcester was May 13th, 2020. New USDA hardiness zone map. For the first time since 2012, a new plant hardiness zone map was released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in November 2023. The map is a tool used by gardeners and growers around the U.S. to determine which plants are most likely to thrive at a precise location. The map, which is considered a guideline for growing perennial plants, was developed by USDA's Agricultural Research Service and Oregon State University's PRISM, PRISM, Climate Group. some New England areas moved into hardier zones, giving gardeners the chance to perhaps try new plants. Our next story focuses again on Winchendon's Lake Monominock. It's by Veer Mundambi of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. Winchendon's Lake Monominock has officially become a worldwide vacation destination as of this month. In the 2024 list of vacation rentals of the year, International Vacation Rental Site, VRBO, listed Copley's Lakefront Cottage as one of its top 10 rentals in the United States and Mexico. The property is a cottage in name only, with three floors, two living rooms, a game room, and office space, in addition to the three bedrooms and three bathrooms. With almost every room having at least one extra bed, it can accommodate as many as 14 people if necessary, according to the VRBO website. While the house itself has plenty to explore, the Belgium-style farmhouse, as it is called on VRBO, comes with a private beach and dock. This area provides all-season activities on the lakeside, including fishing, ice skating, kayaking, and paddleboarding. Multiple rail trails are a short distance away for hiking or cross-country skiing, depending on the time of year. What can you do near Copley Cottage? The Copley Cottage places a vacationer in an ideal spot to access a number of other activities. Mount Wachusett and Mount Monadnock are both only 20 minutes from the property. For the full New England town experience, Keene and Peterborough provide seasonal farmers markets along with berry and apple picking. Boston, Cape Cod, Hampton Beach, and Newport are all less than 2 hours away, making them inviting day trip destinations. How much does it cost? The VRBO website lists the rental as an average of $822 per night. Properties are chosen for the list from over 2 million choices, based on location, host services, guest ratings, and amenities, said VRBO. Originally known as Vacation Rental by Owner, VRBO is headquartered in Austin, Texas, and is owned by the Expedia Group. That concludes this evening's program. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Risa Sachs, reading with Dave Russell. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. In spring, millions of small ducks move into shallow wetlands of North America. Tidal flats, sedge meadows, rice fields, sloughs, and backwaters. When these flocks of ducks erupt from a flooded field, they reveal a dark body with a blaze of green feathers in the wing. Their voices sound like crickets or tiny frogs. These are green-winged teal, North America's smallest dabbling duck. Just over a foot long and weighing less than a pound. As a dabbling duck, they feed from the water's surface by sticking their heads underwater without fully submerging. Around 3 million green-winged teal breed across the northern U.S. and Canada. The male has a cinnamon-brown head with a band of green behind the eye. Both males and females have a green bar on the wing that gleams like an emerald when the sun strikes it. Courtship is elaborate. Males show off with calls and displays, and up to 25 males may court a single female at once. The female selects just one of her many suitors. It's a remarkably competitive courtship ritual that plays out every year. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Remmel.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.